At Today, SOR.
Ireland's human rights record is under the spotlight today in Geneva, with the Minister of State, David Stanton, appearing before the United Nations. The junior minister is taking questions in relation to Ireland's compliance with the UN Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, UNCAT for short. The questioning will be informed to a large extent by a report compiled by Emily Logan, Chief Commissioner of the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission, who's on the line now from Geneva. Emily Logan, thank you indeed for joining us. This is something that happens every, is it 5 or 6 years or thereabouts in Geneva?
Yes, it's every 5 years. So the state delegation will undergo an examination now by a group of international independent experts who are tasked with periodically examining the state's compliance with this convention. This morning, David Stanton, who's the Minister of State for Equality, is accompanied by Ambassador O'Brien, who's the permanent representative of Ireland to the UN in Geneva, and a group of 25 officials across government departments who essentially will all answer questions on compliance with the convention.
Now, you, I think, were involved yesterday in helping to prepare the people asking the questions for today's session. What did you have to tell them?
That's right. There are two sessions. As the National Human Rights Institution in Ireland, I suppose, the independent monitor, if you like, our job is to assist the committee in understanding what's going on in Ireland. So we raised a number of concerns. I suppose in the first instance, it's fair to say that there have been a number of improvements since the committee heard the state 5 years ago. So there are things like the long-awaited closure of St. Patrick's Institution, opened in 1956, where we imprisoned children for 61 years, the abolition of corporal punishment, the abolition of female genital mutilation, the reduction in slopping out for people in prison, improved domestic violence legislation, and then ourselves as a national institution looking at our independence and just making sure that any state is supporting the independent monitor of human rights, because in many other countries that's not the case.
Now, there are other areas, I suppose, where questions will be asked. For instance, Ireland has yet to ratify OPCAT. That's the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture. What is the significance of that, or why might it be important?
Yeah, the optional protocol is about the independent systemic monitoring of all places where people are deprived of their liberty. And traditionally, people understand that as people in prison. But in fact, that now extends to people who are essentially in state care or are in a place or an environment where there's a level of control that means a person may not exercise their free will. So that can include nursing homes, and more recently people will be familiar with residential care centres for people with disabilities, including people with intellectual disabilities. So the importance of that is we have HICWA. People will say, well, we already have HICWA. HICWA produce an inspection report. So this is very much about looking at people's human dignity. The essence of human rights is about the protection of human dignity for every person. People will remember back in 2014 Oris Atracta and what happened in terms of people's treatment there. So HICWA look at the standards for the environment, and I think Phelim Quinn himself has described them as mechanistic standards, and is moving to a more human rights space. So it's about how does the will and preference of those individuals, how is that incorporated? People will remember the visual image of the woman who didn't want to be in the room with the people who were mistreating her. And even though she was described as nonverbal or couldn't communicate verbally, she was certainly able to communicate nonverbally that she was unhappy and she felt that she was mistreated. So that's very much what OPCAT is about. It's making sure that there's an independent monitoring of all of those places. And we know we have a very strong demonstrable history in Ireland of concern about mistreatment of people, in particular in institutions.
And speaking of institutions, maybe of the more modern kind, you have these direct provision centres. Are they featuring in these exchanges?
They are featuring. We were in a meeting yesterday where there were questions really about immigration, how people in the asylum process are treated and looked after when they come to Ireland. So in our report, we have, I suppose, expressed a number of concerns. One, the big one is really about the right to work for people in direct provision. People will be aware of the recent NHV case, the case of a Burmese national who was in direct provision for 9 years, who wasn't allowed to work. That's a case that the court have found is in principle unconstitutional. We've also concern about the 480 people who are now in direct provision who have leave to remain, but I can't actually get out of the system now, because if you're being supported on €19.10 a week, your chances of being able to save for a deposit to get into the rental market are null. So those kind of concerns. And then obviously the psychological concerns and emotional implications of being in situations like that for a protracted period of time.
What about human trafficking and efforts to fight that? Is that something which featured in your own exchanges yesterday?
It is, yeah, it is. It's a big concern. When people are victims of human trafficking, there are two things. The first is the criminal prosecution side of it, but the second is what's called assistance and protection of victims of human trafficking. So when people come into Ireland as victims of human trafficking, at the moment, our legal framework focuses on the criminal aspects. So people might remember the case of a young Vietnamese woman. The Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission was involved in this case in the High Court, where this woman was found locked into a grow house as a victim of human trafficking. And in the absence of that assistance and protection, people aren't getting the kind of support, the kind of counselling that they need, and are more drawn into the criminal prosecution side of things. And what we're saying is we need to have in statute a framework that protects and supports the assistance side of supporting victims of human trafficking.
Now, there's another element of concern, I think, and it may be one in which I think there's a court judgment due in relation to the solitary confinement of children.
That's right. We've been involved in a number of cases on solitary confinement, one for an adult recently, but in this case, it involves the case of four individual children who were in solitary confinement. Now, just to explain that internationally, the term is now recognised as meaning confinement within four walls in circumstances where the person is deprived in terms of sensory deprivation and that you've limited access to human contact. So the interpretation of that is what's a question in this case, where children were put in a room with four walls and didn't have much, had limited access to human contact. The judgment is coming out, I think we're expecting it on the 9th of October, but our job is to independently say to the committee we are concerned about the practice of solitary confinement, in particular for children.
Now, another issue, hundreds of people with disabilities protested outside Leinster House over Ireland's failure so far to ratify the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. What's the story there? Because I know the minister responsible, Finian McGrath, said he wanted to ratify this, but spoke of a clash of rights between the rights of families and the rights of disabled persons.
I think people accept Finian McGrath's bona fides as a long-term disability activist, but I think it's very unhelpful to pit people with disabilities against their carers and their families. People living with disabilities have a right to live independently in their own home. I think probably the more accurate clash, is the clash in public policy in Ireland, which is very old-fashioned in terms of how it translates into people thinking that independent living or living in your own home translates into having to be dependent on your family. And that's not the case. The convention very clearly states that people with disabilities should be supported to live in whatever way they choose to live. For some people, that might mean in an institution. For some people, it might mean in supported community-based living. And for others, it might be independently. The Disability Federation of Ireland actually were on to me yesterday here in Geneva to say that hundreds of people with physical disabilities who are well under the age of 65 are actually living in nursing homes. So they're living in inappropriate environments because the state has not invested in support in the form of personal assistance. Plenty of people, hundreds of people with disabilities, with physical disabilities, would choose to live independently with support. So the state needs to do two things. It needs to respect primarily the interests of people with disabilities and listen to their choice and what they have to say. And of course, they have to respect families who are carers. But there's no clash of rights here. The clash is the interpretation and the old-fashioned public policy that suggests that independent living somehow means that you have to live independently on your family.
Well, Minister McGrath has been saying, in fact, that there is such a clash. She says there's a big debate going on behind the scenes with families. If there is a person with a disability who doesn't want to go into a residential place, well, some of the families would be very, very concerned about that.
Well, and that's fine. I mean, this is about choice. And of course, different families, in the same way that any family lives, different families to choose to live in different ways. The whole idea behind this is that you respect the participatory rights of the individuals with disability and that the state make greater efforts to provide assistance to hearing the individual voices of people with disabilities in the first instance. Of course we need to hear families. But there will be occasions where families don't agree with what their children want to do. In the same way, you as a parent may not agree with how your child chooses to live independently. That's normal. That's normal family relations. That's not a clash of rights. And to suggest by pitting people against each other is really wrong. And it's a narrative that we should really stop. And while I have huge respect for Finian McGrath, I don't think it's okay to allow him to go unchallenged on this.
Right. Now, there's also a question, I suppose, as well about people detained and treated involuntarily, people with maybe intellectual disabilities or in psychiatric care settings. And I know we've heard stories before of the use of chemical restraint. Is this a practice which is coming under scrutiny now today at these exchanges?
It is a practice that was raised yesterday by a member of the committee, and it is something that has been raised by the CEO of HICWA in April of this year. He referred to the overuse of chemical restraint in the context of intellectual disability. So yes, that would be considered a huge concern. I mean, the people who are monitoring that and inspecting that are HICWA, and they provide the data and the information independently. I think it's probably early days because that comment has only been made by Philem Quinn in April of this year, but certainly from a committee's point of view, they will be asking tough questions on that today.
And what about attention paid to historical abuses, the treatment of survivors here, be they survivors of the Magdalen laundries, mother and baby homes, or indeed people who had that infamous symphysiotomy procedure?
I think what, generally looking at this, the UN set, I suppose, there are international standards for best practice around undertaking historic abuse inquiries. So what they're looking for some key things to make sure that the inquiries are taking place independently of government, that any institution has powers of compellability so that they're able to access all information and to establish the truth of what happened to determine whether there were any human rights abuses. And then also looking at restitution. So sometimes that's financial compensation. But they are, interestingly enough, putting an emphasis this time on non-financial reparations. So looking at rehabilitation, looking at not only apologies, looking at memorialising, talking to individuals who are victims or survivors of abuse and what it is that would make them and help them feel that they have been acknowledged in the state and that the state has both been accountable for its action but also publicly apologises and seeks the truth. And finally, it's very difficult to close off the historic abuses that we've had, largely because for many people they feel that the truth has yet to be uncovered.
What about abortion?
What about abortion? Well, I suppose at this stage the UN is interested in what the state has committed to, and at this stage they're aware that the Taoiseach in his first speech committed to holding a referendum in 2018 and that there's a dedicated parliamentary committee that will hold its first public session on the 20th of September. So they're looking at, they're not getting into the fine detail of what would be entailed in that, but they are interested in human rights compliance. From our point of view as a commission, we have highlighted concerns in relation to three groups of people, women from lower socioeconomic groups, women who are immigrant women who may not have travel documentation, and then women with disabilities who may not be in a position to travel.
Just one other point, Emily Logan. I think you mentioned in your first answer that there's not just Minister of State David Stanton, but he's accompanied by 25 officials. That is one hell of an entourage.
It is. What I would say to you is it is. What I would say is that the UN, this is a really, really formal process, and the UN are interested to see how any state, whether the state respects the process, because it's a process of independent international public accountability where the Irish state is publicly accounting for its progress in relation to human rights. So they will look favourably on the fact that there is a minister at the table and a number of officials. I suppose the breadth and the specificity of some of the standards that are in this convention are very technical, and you wouldn't expect any minister to be able to answer all the questions. So it's
no, but maybe five or six, or even three well-informed officials on top of their job should be able to access, and also with modern communications, if something needs to be checked within a matter of minutes, the information could be brought forward. I mean, 25 of them.
Well, I suppose that's a question you should put to the government and not to me. But I think, just generally speaking, the UN looks very favourably on Ireland's reputation on human rights more generally. And the fact that it's being taken so seriously by the government is looked upon favourably.
Okay, well, look, thank you indeed for joining us. That's Emily Logan there, Chief Commissioner at the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission, on the line from Geneva. Thank you. And in fact, just a hand from a news release issued by the Department of Justice, the full list of participants with the Minister of State, David Stanton, Jimmy Martin, Assistant Secretary, Prisons Policy Division, Department of Justice and Equality, Michael Donlan, Director General, Irish Prison Service, Siobhan O'Halloran, Mental Health Unit, Department of Health, Martina Feeney, Director of Human Rights, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Alison Enright, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Angus O'Hengisa, Redress Unit, Department of Education Skills, Chris Quattriocini, if I pronounce that correctly, and I don't think I do, Prisons Policy Division, Department of Justice and Equality, Deglan O'Brien, Equality Division, Department of Justice and Equality, Greg Halen, Crime Division, Department of Justice, James Gibbs, Mother and Baby Homes Investigations Unit, Department of Children and Youth Affairs, John Gary, Criminal Law Reform Division, Department of Justice, John Harding, National Patient Safety Unit, Department of Health, Kathleen Connolly, Policing Division, Department of Justice and Equality, Keith Lynn, Prisons Policy Division, Department of Justice, Michael Murchan, Mental Health Unit, Department of Health, Mick Quinn, Irish Naturalisation and Immigration Service, Department of Justice and Equality, Noel Dowling, Prisons Policy Division, Department of Justice, Sarah Rose Flynn, Assistant Principal Officer, International and Research Policy Unit, Department of Health, Tracy O'Keefe, Principal Officer at the Civil Law Reform Division, Department of Justice, and Yvonne Phillips, Private Secretary to the Minister of State. Now, I think that's 20 names, but lest we be accused of throwing stones for the comfort of glass houses, if they were representing RTÉ at the Eurovision in Stockholm, there would have been an entourage of 18 in that. More after the break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTÉ Radio 1.